Welcome to the Norris Group's Real Estate Radio Show. Hosted by author, investor, hard money lender, and real estate educator, Bruce Norris. Equipping California real estate professionals for tomorrow's challenges.
Hi, thank you for joining us. My name is Bruce Norris. Today, our guest is Craig Hill. Craig's been handling the Norris Group's hard money loan business for over 10 years and is himself a trustee investor. Craig, welcome to our show.
Thanks, Bruce.
When most people think of lending, they think of B of A or FHA. The loan business you've always been attached to has been known as the private lending business. What's the main difference?
Well, there really isn't as much of a difference maybe as people think. All the technical aspects of it are the same as far as documentation and what you need. It's just really you're lending to a different client, and it can be for many reasons. A lot of times with regards to what we do when we're dealing with investors buying properties, we're lending on a very quick time frame. We're lending on maybe properties that a bank wouldn't lend on due to condition or things of that nature. It's really not what a lot of people think, at least what we do. It really doesn't have as much to do with, say, credit as a lot of people might think. It's more a need or necessity due to speed or something of that nature.
The funding source for a B of A would be very different than the private money world. So that's the main thing that's, to me, very different.
Yeah, exactly. That's on the funding side, exactly, where B of A, it's a pool of money. With hard money, it's basically an individual, LLC, a company, somebody that has some money to lend and would like to get a good return on it, and then they just take the place of B of A in terms of funding.
Right. Under the umbrella of private lending is this word called hard money.
Yes.
So describe to me what hard money lending is.
Well, I think to me, hard money really has just been the generalized term for private money.
Okay.
In other words, anytime it's a private loan, where it's a broker, we at the Norris Group are the broker, and we're setting up a individual or a company going into the loan as an investor. That technically is what a hard money loan is.
Okay, hard is also, it seems that a negative term because of expense. Has it been known to be real expensive money?
Yeah, hard money. I think a lot of times in the past, it does have a negative aspect to it and how it's perceived. But a lot of times hard money, going back even, you know, the years before we worked together, hard money was often lent to people that had very bad credit, things of that nature, very high risk. So when you were dealing with that type of client, you were paying a higher fees and higher interest rate. But once again, there probably weren't a whole lot of options for those people either.
Right. When we first met, you were working with another company in Orange County. And at that point, who was your typical client almost exclusively?
Yeah, basically when we met, my typical client probably was somebody that had a first trust deed. They were delinquent on it. They needed to borrow maybe a $20,000 second just to kind of get them squared away, hopefully.
Mm-hmm.
So most of the loans were second trust deeds to people that had poor credit. Maybe had lost their job or, you know, some kind of circumstance where it got them behind. And this hopefully was a way for them to kind of get everything squared away and then move forward from there.
When you and I met, I was an investor. I had found a couple of properties, and I had been buying up to the maximum of my either credit line or cash. So I was kind of done, and that's if I put out an all-out search bulletin for money, and I really had no idea what I was going to find. And you and I had our first conversation when I had two properties that I had bought at an auction.
Yes.
And it's interesting. It was my first meeting with a hard money lender and your first meeting with the investor world. And it's interesting to me that those two hadn't got together before.
Yeah, I was actually shocked. That is just an interesting point, because that was probably, 1994 maybe when we met?
Three or four. Yeah.
And here you came to me with two properties where typical loan-to-values, if people are familiar with that, that's how much you're willing to lend on a value of a property. So just kind of to go in that a little bit, if you had a house that was worth $100,000, hard money lenders were willing to lend maybe 60 to 70%. That gives you a broad range, but of what that house was worth. And this was to the aforementioned clients that had never paid, were behind on their mortgage. And here you came along, and you had two houses that you had just purchased, and let's say if they were a little lower at the time, but just using the 100% as a reference, you really were only asking to borrow 50 to 60% of what that house was worth.
Right.
And it was amazing to me because here was somebody that had good credit, cash reserves, only wanted to borrow 50 or 60% of what this house was worth. And a light went on in my head that this was a great avenue. And I think we both know the funny part of that story is I had a hard time getting those first few loans through because the mentality then was a house was worth what somebody paid for it. Even if the next door neighbor lived in the exact house and we could appraise both houses that were identical, but technically back then they would have wanted to lend more to the person in foreclosure.
Well, when you look at a hard money loan model that it, as it existed in the 90s before we met, there was usually a first trust deed on a property taking up a fair amount of that potential room to borrow. So you usually had to be doing loans that were the second position, but also really quite small.
Yes. The typical loan probably was between, I would say half the loans that I did back then were probably between $10,000 and $25,000.
Okay.
Almost all seconds. Behind, you know, at the time, the first were probably maybe 60 or 70. So the percentage was always, you know, probably 80% of the amount owed on the property was in the first. And then here was a little small second behind the first.
Right.
And that was typical. It might have even been more than 50% at the time.
What was the interest rate or points? Do you have any remembrance of that?
I do. Typically, it was probably, this once again was going back, but I'd say around 15%, 10 to 15 points. One other item to mention, most of the companies that did hard money dealt with brokers. And what I mean by that is here was a hard money company that had the money. That's the company that I worked for when we met. And you had other people referring us these deals, these little $10,000, $20,000 deals. And if there was 10 or 15 points, the broker got half of that just for referring them.
I got you.
So there was a little bit more, there was a few more people involved in the transaction. And a lot of times that was unfortunate.
You know, that's a point that I think maybe is worth covering and stopping there for a second. We don't do any of those loans. We have no referral base intentionally, and that's
yes.
From your experience that sometimes that didn't work out so well.
Yeah, exactly. That's one of the great things. I mean, we have such a network that we don't need to do referrals. We deal direct with principals only.
Mm-hmm.
And just a quick story without, you know, no specifics, but I mean, time after time, I had to try to convince the broker that it made more sense for these people to get a $15,000 second and charge them those fees on a $15,000 loan when the referring broker wanted me to do a new $80,000 first trust deed.
Right.
Because that generated more income.
Correct.
So I like the fact that we can just always do what's best direct with the client.
I would think that most hard money loan businesses are still very much set up with a referral base. I mean, and also, I guess sometimes you don't always hear. If you're not talking to the person borrowing, is there a filter sometimes from what really the situation is and what you actually hear if you're on the other end of that?
Yeah, exactly. Another great point. When you're dealing with the broker giving you the information, oftentimes the only contact I had with the actual client was maybe a brief phone call setting up the meeting and then trying to figure out exactly what was going on, you know, when I was actually signing the client.
Right.
And that's sometimes is hard to do because, you know, the broker might paint the picture one way and maybe it's actually a different way.
Right. When you and I first met and after a while we got pretty comfortable talking to each other because we realized we were having the same conversations. I was talking to the person in foreclosure who wanted to sell it. probably someone you couldn't loan to, and you were talking to him about making loans. So we were actually having the very same conversations with the very same people.
Yeah, that was we were absolutely having the same conversation. It was the same group of people either trying to buy or trying to sell their house because they were in trouble or trying to borrow money because they were in trouble.
As I remember, you had said that you had heard, certainly investors had come to you before, but it was with a concept rather than with a property.
Yeah, that had always been kind of like a web that had always been kind of in the background. People would always say, I can do this or I can do that. And if I do that, could you do this? Kind of trying to get an idea what I might do in some
right.
pretend scenario. But once again, when you came and with the first two deals after we had our conversation, then you brought the first two deals, it was amazing the security I thought it gave the investor. Lending, we've been talking a lot about first and seconds.
Mm-hmm.
First of all, when we lent to you, it was a purchase money first.
Right.
So now we're in first position. We're not in second position. And literally a light went on in my head, and I started to try to lend only to investors.
Mm-hmm.
And ultimately, that's what I did.
Well, you've always been good at grasping at the best model as quickly
yes.
as possible.
Yeah.
That's interesting, bringing that up. Who was the second investor?
Well, if I using a name, second investor was actually a gentleman named Mike Cantu, which a lot of people might be familiar with. So
yeah.
If you want to know why maybe I'm a little spoiled, you know, my first two clients were Bruce Norris and then Mike Cantu. So I felt if this works for these two people, this is a very good concept.
What's also important about, and the reason why I wanted to ask that question was, Mike Cantu's still doing business with us, borrowing money.
Yes,
and that's a consistency that couldn't happen for either a loan business or the people that invested in the trustees if you were loaning to somebody that occupied a property.
Exactly. Once again, looking more at the model of dealing with investors, you would scratch and claw trying to get maybe. You know, 20 people, different people to borrow money one time.
Right.
Once I met you and Mike, I had two people that could probably borrow 40 or 50 times a year from me.
Yeah.
Combined. And it didn't take me long to realize that made a lot of sense.
Interestingly enough, most people think of the investor as the risky borrower and the occupant as the safe one. And I've learned through you and through experience, that's not true. But,
yeah.
Still that's the perception that the investor is risky. What are some of the pitfalls when you're loaning to an occupant borrower, even assuming they are current? I mean, given the 90s, people had equity because it was exploding all the time and, you know, people were borrowing on that constantly. But even without that, are there some rules that are in place for the occupant owner that are protective in ways that aren't necessarily there for investors?
Yeah, there's a lot more protection set up for the owner-occupant. There's a lot more regulations on loan amounts and things you can and can't do. And I think one of the biggest things for me, and it's kind of abstract, but when I'm doing a loan for an investor, I understand the reason he's borrowing the money is because he just bought a house,
mm-hmm.
and he's going to fix it up, and he's going to sell it. Now, you know, everything's not perfect, but I understand what he's trying to do.
Mm-hmm.
To me, when you're lending to the owner-occupant, you probably don't ever really know why he's borrowing money.
Okay.
Because it could be for any reasons. And I learned, you know, through the vast history, I mean, I've had numerous cases where you find out as soon as the loan closes. And I don't, where you're just kind of shocked what the real reason they're borrowing is.
One thing that's a given is that we're not the cheapest resource for them to borrow.
Yes.
That's always, as far as that, the occupant, every loan program that exists is less interest and less points than
right.
a hard money lender.
Right. So, yes. Yeah, exactly. So the reason they might borrow, once again, exactly, is because this is like their only way to borrow.
Right.
Whereas an investor, it's more of a, it comes down to maybe need versus just practical or something. But the owner-occupant definitely has a need, and they just have to do it this way.
Right.
The investor, in most cases, has an option to use this, and it's for many reasons. A lot of times, just for simplicity, for speed, but it's not because it's their last resort.
when an investor comes to us with a property, what steps are taken to ensure they're, in fact, a capable borrower and they have the type of property we're interested in making a loan on?
Yeah, looking first at the investor that we deal with, the person buying the property, you look for basic things. You do look at their credit. I'm more interested in their how much they owe, like how leveraged they are versus their actual score, because in this type of market, a lot of people still have, you know, 700 scores, but they might be in debt 80 to 90% on their credit cards or even more. So, mm-hmm. so they don't have much leverage. And then also you want to look at, we want to look at their cash reserves, because somebody with good cash reserves is really a good candidate to be doing this, because it does require cash, you know, to be an investor in this market.
Absolutely. Type of property?
Basically, the type of properties that we really heavily favor in this market, we're going to be doing mainly single-family residences. We will do some units, some small units. We've, as you know, we've always stayed away from commercial. Right now, we wouldn't be doing any land. There's a time down the road where we'll probably be doing a lot of construction loans, because it'll make sense then. But right now, we just really try to do cookie-cutter properties. And one thing I tell a lot of new people is I kind of ask them how they found the property. Mm-hmm. And how long has it been on the market? And the thing I use with a lot of new people is I say, well, you really didn't find that property. It found you. Because there's a lot of investors out there looking. And if a property's been on the market for like 60 days with no price change, and a new investor says, Craig, I have this and it's a good deal, I'm a little bit cautious, just because I just there's probably a reason why it's still on the market.
A couple of points that just came to mind. There's, you know, this world of flipping where somebody finds this really great wholesale deal and then they flip it to another wholesale buyer that doesn't really have the capacity to find stuff, but they want to get in the game.
Yes.
And as long as there's a margin, you know, that's okay. But lately there hasn't been much of that margin. And also sometimes the fees that are tacked on to these new people take up really all the profit potential there if it was in the deal.
Yeah, exactly. Most of your good people, wholesalers, we called them, you referenced, most of the wholesalers, they get a pretty nominal fee for the work that they've done.
Mm-hmm.
And then they will flip it to somebody, and there's a lot of potential in there. But as a matter of fact, I'll just tell you, I got a phone call just the other day. This was yesterday. And it was a deal where the guy was buying the numbers are approximate, maybe a $400,000 house, and it was offered to him at $349,000.
Mm-hmm.
And he thought it was really a good deal until he went back and found out that the guy, the original person had just paid $249,000 for it. So that's a perfect example of what you're saying. Had he just settled for, say, a reasonable fee, you would have had two people that would have been satisfied.
And maybe a client that would come back for a second property.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah, the way that one was set up, that wouldn't have been true.
Yeah, no. That would have been one time only.
Okay. You mentioned the word cycles. You've been in the business for kind of a long time before.
Yes.
You and I met, too. How important are cycles in decision making in your capacity as you look at something?
Well, I mean, cycles are absolute the most important thing, and that's one thing that we've been able to do together a lot, since your expertise is predicting cycles. There's just certain cycles, which we're in one now. It's a good cycle, but you still have to be careful of what you lend on.
Yes.
If the cycle is moving up, which we're a long way from that, but when the cycles are on the way up, you certainly can do. We earlier went loan to value. We talked about loan to value per mm-hmm. 100,000. When the market is on the upswing, you might be able to raise your loan to value a little bit. You can do things like construction loans. In a cycle like this, one of the things I try to stay away from is something that might take 6 months to be completed.
Right.
Because things could change very quickly in 6 months, because we've seen that twice in the last 12 months. We've seen October to March of last year, almost just the wind was out of the sails. And then we've seen, with lack of inventory, we've seen the last 6 months almost a cycle where the investor, and I think this is dangerous for some investors, it's almost been a can't-lose situation over the last 6 months if they're doing it even reasonably well, because you're buying something, and as soon as you fix it up, it's almost like you have a fever of people wanting to buy your property because there's a lack of inventory. So I really try to tell people that, you know, that can change, because sometimes what happens if they feel like they can't miss, then they pay too much. Like, let's say they've just had a successful couple transactions over the last 3 or 4 months. Mm-hmm. Well, now maybe they're so excited that they want to buy two more before the end of the year. There's a lot of competition for the buys, so maybe they pay too much. And if something happens over the winter, I mean, you could end up with a couple of losers.
The other thing that happens in that cycle where the inventory is small is people take on what we would call project houses,
yes,
where it's not simple.
Right.
You know, now they're moving
exactly
walls, or they're doing lots and lots of construction. And that,
right,
we usually sure try to steer people clear of those project houses, especially without the experience.
Exactly. One of the questions I ask, getting back to that, is when I talk to a client, I ask if they have any background in construction, or if they, a lot of our clients are contractors, or they have been, or their father is, or the son is. So if that's the case, you can do that. But I have a lot of new people will tell me this property is red tagged by the city, or this, you know, and, mm-hmm, and whenever that's the case, I just think that's a little too much for a brand new investor.
Yes. You know, we have people come to us a lot of times that fully expect that we're going to loan them money, because they've heard from, if they attend any seminar club in the state, you'll have some hard money lender get up there and go, no credit score necessary, no down. We're really not built that way.
Yeah, and it's funny. I have a lot of disappointing conversations with people, I'm sure, but I will tell you, I would say the majority of them are very thankful, because I feel like, or they feel like for the first time, maybe somebody has really said, okay, here's what you need. Here's what you need to, you know. What I try to do is when we do the application with people, if they're qualified, that's great. I'll approve them for a certain amount. If they're not, then I try to say, if you could maybe do this, you might be in a better position to buy. But I can't tell you, Bruce, and I know we've talked about this before, how many people come to me and let's say they might need about $30,000 to do a deal.
Right.
I ask them, how much do you have? And they'll say, well, I have $6,000 in my savings account. I have $18,000 on my credit cards and about $20,000 in my IRA.
Right.
And they really want to do this because, as you mentioned, they've been told that this is very easy to do.
Mm-hmm.
And I kind of equate that to going all in.
Right.
Here's the most difficult time in real estate market maybe ever.
Right. Very changing market.
Very volatile. And mm-hmm, here's somebody that's about to take the little cushion that they have and go all in on a property. And as I tell them, it doesn't mean that it's a bad buy. They might end up with a rental that really is a pretty good long-term rental.
Right.
But how is that if you have absolutely no cushion at all? And most of them are very thankful because they at least want to know what they may be getting into.
A lot of people came from the 2000 to 2006 or 7 mentality, where everything you touched, no matter how inefficient you were, tossed out a big check. And
yes,
now
yes,
it's not the same. Anything inefficient in your model will cost you a lot of money.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's when I mentioned the last, say, 6 months, we've almost had a mini 2000 to 2007.
Right,
and that's very, that's very scary.
Yeah.
Because once again, I think people, and you mentioned before, there's a lot of people that, you know, do seminars and learn, but a lot of people don't, in my opinion, aren't hands-on enough.
Right.
They delegate a little bit too much. And once again, when you do that, I just feel like that's a potential for problems also.
Okay. Well, we need to wrap up this first segment.
Yes.
Craig, glad that you were able to join us.
Yes,
you can reach Craig at the Norris Group at 951-780-5856, and he'll be glad to talk to you about either borrowing money or investing in a trust deed. So thank you for joining us, and we will continue talking to Craig on our next segment.
You've been listening to the Norris Group Real Estate Radio Show. For more information on the Norris Group, please visit www.thenorrisgroup.com.